Talk to us now and go to the TNT Radio Interactive live chat room at tntradio.live. Lighting the fuse for freedom. Today's News Talk Radio, TNT. Using science to debunk myths. From the pandemic to climate fraud. Thanks for listening to Sky Dragon Slaying on TNT Radio.
All right, welcome back to our second hour with William Kay. William is a qualified lawyer. He used to practice law for a short while. Then he got into broadcasting and writing. And you've written a couple of very interesting books. We love publishing your work on Principia Scientific. And what I'd like to talk about with you, William, is this issue of population control. One of your books, which I really it struck a chord with me, From Malthus to Mifepristone, A Primer on the Population Control Movement. And we've been talking about Malthus at Principia Scientific for 12 years. And, you know, we think he's the root of a lot of the excuses that the green movement use. It limits to growth. The idea that the planet has got limited resources, we're using them up through overpopulation, and they're appealing to those uneducated folk who seem to go along with the narrative that, that there are too many of us. And, you know, give us a bit of a summary of your analysis of that, if you can, William.
Well, on the issue of environmentalism, practically every major green organization in the world, yes, is a Malthusian organization. There was a time when they were very open and explicit about it, but many of them over the decades have learned to just separate themselves, from the population control movement itself. However, if you dig into the literature, there, one and all, every one of them believes that the environment can only be protected by restraining population growth or rolling back population growth. But the population control movement can be distinguished. There are several dozen other organizations. These are structured organizations that are chartered. They have boards of directors. They have annual general meetings. They have budgets, etc. There are several dozen organizations like the Population Council of New York City, like the United Nations Population Fund, which has a budget probably of $300 or $400 million a year. The Population Council has a budget of over $100 million a year, and it's a very sketchy organization because it has a monopoly over mifepristone in the United States. This is a group that was set up by John D. Rockefeller III because he believed that welfare-dependent, criminalistic subhumans were overbreeding in American cities, and that's why he created the population control movement, and they now have the license for the number one abortifacient pill in the United States, and it's just... If you know the history of the human experimentation that went into creating abortion, abortifacient pills and birth control pills, you know, hundreds and hundreds of thousands of women were killed around the third world with various human experiments trying to come up with better contraceptives and better sort of sterilants and what have you. That went on in the past. But we still today have quite a network of organizations that are explicitly devoted to promoting the concept that Earth is overpopulated, and the entire, you know, this movement itself is 150, 200 years old. The legalization of contraceptives would not have happened without them. The legalization and creating of abortion on demand would not have happened without them. They've had a profound influence on culture. Much of the promotion of homosexuality and transgenderism, etc., these are subsidiary projects of this much larger centralized movement. But it is not a conspiracy. I mean, these are structured organizations with people involved in them. You can, they have websites. You can visit them. They are rather secretive. They are rather large. They are not as vocal or as embedded in the state that they as they once were. In terms of explicitly population control, that would be the late 60s, early 70s. Well, I remember this well. I'm old enough to remember there was a time when, you know, overpopulation was front page news. It was a bigger scare than global warming. And it was entirely a hoax. You know, you're talking to Canadians here. This is one big empty planet. We could easily add tens of billions of people to this planet, and it would be a better place. It's not an issue at all. What it is about an oligarchy or elements within the oligarchy that are paranoid and that value stability above all else and are convinced that uncontrolled breeding of certain populations, certain subpopulations is bad. There's all sorts of classist and racist subtext to this whole movement, but they are very much in power. Well, you know, they're very much a powerful, influential social movement. Now, if you look at the scale of the LGBT campaign, I, without a doubt, I can put that down as a subsidiary of the population control movement. That's the scale. I mean, the amount of cultural sweep that this group has. You know, Malthusianism remains popular amongst the oligarchy. I'll say that.
Do you really think that the world would be better with, I don't know, because typically on PSI, most of us are INTJ personality types. I'm not sure what you are. But we typically don't like a lot of people, just to be honest. Do you really think the world would be better with 10 billion more people? Because, man, I generally don't like people. Yeah. You know what I
mean? Oh, more the merrier. More the merrier. Yeah, well, what we have to agree on is that we're under no ecological pressure. It isn't as though that we've sort of all banged up against some wall of how much agricultural land we can bring in. One of the articles I posted on PSI was popular. Actually, believe it or not, this was delivered to a cabinet minister in Brazil, and it was about about the Amazon River Basin and what the agricultural potential of that area is. It is bigger than the European Union. It's absolutely empty. It is a combination of equatorial sunshine and the world's greatest a collection of fresh water. The hectares in the Amazon Delta often have more than 100 species of tree in them. You could turn that whole area into a rice paddy. You could feed billions upon billions of people. And the same goes for the Congo. The same goes for Western North America. Big empty spaces with tremendous agricultural potential.
Yeah, so your position is that
the planet's overpopulated is a lie.
Yeah, so if that potential is there, you're saying we should do that? Because obviously they would say, you know, we shouldn't do that. We should limit population. Remember the George Guidestones. I said 500 million people. You think, alternatively, that definitely since the potential is there, we should do that?
Oh, absolutely. Throw open those areas. It should be, this is how the West was won. You know, you build railways through them and you open up the land on either side of the railway for cultivation, mining, forestry, whatever you can. Mm-hmm. Absolutely. Yeah. There should be no effort whatsoever to preserve wilderness.
No,
that
I think you don't need to.
That is nonsense.
You don't need to be a genius just to look at a satellite map of the Earth at night and just see the blackness of the planet and the few specks of white light around coastal regions. It's a great clue to how little of the planet is actually populated. And not only that, since 2019, even the UN has admitted that over 50% of the population are now congregated into cities. So we're moving out of the country, aren't we? We're being forced into tighter and tighter compacted suburban urban areas. That gives the impression that we are overpopulated. It's very clever, isn't it? Because real estate is getting more expensive. I was in London the other week and I noticed, you know, the incredible overcrowding, and people put up with this. And it's the same with every major metropolis. You've got rush hour, you've got people congested in traffic, you've got the underground, you've got the tube overcrowded, and it's kind of an illusion, isn't it? It's not reality, because you can go out of London, you can go into the countryside, and you don't see a soul. So it's quite clever how they play into the psyche, isn't it, William?
There's a good book came out of the Adam Smith Institute about 15 years ago called Liberating the Land. And it discusses public opinion polls in the UK. And yet, the average Brit thinks that the whole country is paved over. They don't think there is any sort of vacant land out there. And what you do have is a lot of very valuable land, those green belts around London, that they keep out of development. And it's clearly a program to cartelize land and keep land prices astronomically high. So, you know, Canada, all the major cities have these huge green spaces in them. They could simply auction them off and the land prices would collapse. You know, you'd probably get hung from the nearest tree if you ever actually implemented that. I lived in Vancouver for 15, 16 years. I wrote this one piece called Brother, Can You Spare a Hectare? Because there's these enormous green spaces right in the middle of the city. The green spaces, if you include Bowen Island, which is just off the shore of West Vancouver, the green space in Greater Vancouver is four times larger than the residential space. And if you go to Toronto, they have this huge green belt around. There's a huge fight now going on about trying to develop it. But they are clearly using green space and ecological arguments and wilderness preservation and heritage preservation arguments to take vast amounts of land off development. It's frustrating economic growth, and it's causing astronomical housing prices. It's so much human tragedy. It's such a joke that in a country like Canada that we would be dealing with the housing crisis that we are, but we are. And it's just a joke that we're not resolving it. And the idea, I've seen articles in the Edmonton Journal saying that Edmonton has run out of space to grow. That, you know, you could put all of Tokyo Yokohama into Edmonton city limits. You could put all of Canada, if it was as dense as Tokyo Yokohama, would be inside Edmonton city limits. There's vast room to grow. And there's this myth that we've somehow come up against any limits.
Yeah, Bye. I'd like to hear Joe Olson. Joe Olson, you haven't said very much on this. Would you like to add your own view on this?
Oh, yeah. Well, they're trying to hurt us every way possible. We've also got the UN, who's in charge of CODEX, which is going to be our new food supply monitoring system. And they've already authorized 97,000 varieties of insects that we'll be eating. So in addition to not owning anything, you'll be eating a lot of bugs. And now they're working on an international pandemic treaty, which they hope to have in place by 2024, in which the unappointed head of the UN has unilateral right to declare worldwide pandemics and every method necessary to control those pandemics. And as we know, these people just love lockdowns and forced jabs and forced nasal testing and, you know, absolutely anything they can think of to make life as miserable as possible for us. So we have people that are just determined to control everybody else on the planet. And then they don't have to live by those same rules because, just like you mentioned at COP27, they all fly in their private jets and they sit around and eat filet mignon while telling us that we're going to eat a nice plate of crickets. Absolutely, the whole thing is just completely insane. And why people put up with this is beyond me. But maybe we're at the point where we're going to have a little bit of a break, because Musk is exposing a whole lot of things that are going on with Twitter and the U.S. government. And recently, today, as a matter of fact, Jeff Bezos announced that he was going to have massive layoffs at the WAPU because they've had 500,000 subscribers cancel their subscriptions to Washington Post. And then also, he's just announced his brand new Rivia electric delivery vans, and he plans on having 100,000 of those on the streets by 2030. So he's going to be right there with the green agenda, folks. And I saw an interview a guy did with one of the drivers of the new Rivia trucks. He goes, "How do you like these things?" He goes, "Oh, these things are miserable." He said they got less than 150-mile range, and that's during the good season. He said during the winter, they've got half that a mile of range. So you've got to be sitting there parking these things ridiculous amount of charging time in order to do this virtue signaling electric vehicle garbage. And, you know, so bottom line is they can't continue to do this many charades simultaneously and not have the house of cards start to fall apart. And all we're doing is we're pulling on every thread imaginable, particularly the scientific threads, to bring this thing down, because we don't deserve this. And what we do deserve is to have a evidence-based, scientifically based society where we have things that are logical and beneficial to everybody on the planet and not just to this particular bloodline group of psychopaths that's been able to put themselves in charge of the planet for the last several hundred years.
Yeah, well said. At the top of the episode, William Kay, you made the very good point that what is needed is a blue versus red team debate. And that's what we offer at Principia Scientific International. Yeah. And it does appear to be the case now. If we are listening to the latest reports coming from Elon Musk at Twitter, we might well get that debate if Twitter does become a less politicized open forum. And I greatly welcome that. And do you feel that will happen, William?
Well, Elon, I call him Climate Boy. Elon has been preaching global warming alarmism since he first bought stock in Tesla in 2004. You can go online and there are countless Elon Musk videos where he waxes on about the apocalypse that's going to happen if we don't stop global warming. He has bought it hook, line, and sinker. He's been promoting it. He didn't just invest in electric cars. He also invests heavily in solar power and battery storage. Much of his fortune is tied up in the climate industrial complex. He offers a $100 million prize for carbon reduction technologies. Now, he is an agent of the climate industrial complex. His capturing of Twitter is a capturing of a important social media node that no doubt will be used to advance the climate agenda. He is up to his neck in climate industrial investments. Now, he's the last person. I really don't like the guy.
Yeah, words of caution about Elon Musk. We'll come back to this issue right after the break. This is TNT Radio.
TNT Radio's Timothy Shea.
Do you think I'll ever get tired of coming on and saying, we were right, they were wrong, we told you so? Yeah, no, I'm never going to get tired of that. But guess what? I get to say it again today. Because guess what? We were right, they were wrong. Twitter censored Donald Trump and political candidates in advance of the 2020 election. That's called election tampering. At the very least, it's an in-kind donation to those Democrat campaigns. Where is the Federal Election Commission on this? So what's the fair market value of letting Democrats have the floor, not letting Republicans speak? What is the fair market value of allowing one political candidate to be able to reach voters, but not his or her opponent? Seems to me the value is self-evident. But you can get an economist to actually put a dollar value on that.
The Reckoning with Timothy Shea on today's News Talk, TNT Radio.
This is a message for the parents of young children in the United States. I am Dr. Tess Laurie from the World Council for Health. Please consider the danger of vaccinating your children and babies with the COVID-19 injections. They are not the same as traditional vaccines and are causing significant harm to children around the world. Your children have their whole lives ahead of them. They are not endangered by COVID at all. Please hear us when we say, for your children, it is much safer to wait. Thank you.
Come on, speak up.
Speak. You must tell us.
Speak.
This is today's News Talk Radio, TNT.
William Kay, we've been talking about Elon Musk before the break, and You're a bit disillusioned by the guy. You don't think he's going to be a force for good. I'm open-minded. I think that a leopard can change his spots, especially if he's been threatened with Guantanamo Bay. We've heard about this before. The idea that there's a kind of white hat versus black hat thing going on behind the scenes. You know, the BRICS movement. Russia is now becoming a force for those nations that are anti-West, if you like. The Five Eyes, the Anglophone nations, that they're definitely in the retreat, aren't they? So if globalism looks to be under threat, and my instinct is the BRICS nations are emerging, and that there is some hope there. And Elon Musk is South African, after all. You know, can we keep some idea that perhaps he could have been switched, you know, from black hat to white hat?
Well, he remains someone whose fortune is primarily Tesla and various other climate industrial complex, solar energy, battery storage companies. That is his stock in trade. That is what he's speaking on behalf of that. And to repeat, you can find umpteen videos of him online staring into the camera telling a big lie about the climate. And what is the end result of this big lie? It is the severe sabotaging of the economic foundations of Canada, USA, and Australia. He is participating in an economic warfare stratagem. He is not from these shores, and that is why I don't like him.
Well, you know, I want to bring something up. That's such a good point. You know, he has never really said anything to, you know, people like what he's doing with, you know, people are thrilled by the Tesla cars because they're high torque, you know, wow, really cool. Practically, you know, you could never use them in Canada, for example, where we live, William, they'd be terrible here. Well, people do have them. Actually, I saw somebody driving on, anyway, yeah, minus 20 degrees Celsius. I'm like, well, that person's going to drive about 20 kilometers and then he did. And then the other thing, obviously, that he's doing is SpaceX. Yeah, I mean, the rockets are really fun to watch. But, however, here's the point. I've never actually heard or read Elon say anything that's actually all that intelligent. Like, honestly, if you really look at his tweets, he's never actually said anything philosophically intelligent and even scientifically intelligent. He says, we need to go to Mars, so I'm going to build a rocket. Okay, wow, science. But that's not really particularly scientifically intelligent. He's never really said anything cognitively, you know, intellectually stimulating. What do you think, William?
I had something that really comes through. I tortured myself. I sat through a bunch of his videos and just platitudinous, dull as dishwater, just repeating the talking points from the Climate Alarmist campaign. A really bland, not engaging speaker, like no indication of any sort of spark whatsoever. You got to think he's maybe some sort of idiot savant, or maybe his brother had all the brains. I'm not sure, but I'm not impressed. And just like I say, just all of the cliche climate alarmist slogans told in just a deadpan.
He's not impressive at all as an intellect, like not at all. Like, sure, is he an engineer? Maybe we can call him an engineer. He seems to be pretty involved with developing these rockets and his rocket engines. Okay, so he's an engineer, but I guess that's good.
There's this whole weird thing about his father. I don't know. And whether or not he got much of a start in life from his father. Elon broke down crying in a Rolling Stone interview about his father, who he said was a murderer and all sorts of other weird things. So if you get into that dark, the real South African half of the family, his father apparently was an emerald mining owner. And apparently he's a pretty hardcore person on a variety of other issues, but there's something really sketchy about his past there. And his father claims that he did provide the seed capital for Elon and his brother, and Elon and the brother deny this now. So who knows? Yeah, whatever they did that turned into PayPal, that was the first pile of money, and he only put $6 million into Tesla, and he bought the company in 2004. And then it really took off, but it's all without the climate change, without the whole push behind electromobility, that company does not exist. I still think it's a horrible investment.
Well, people have made an extremely good point. Well, yeah, people have made an extremely good point that really all of his money has come from government subsidies. Even SpaceX is largely funded by the government. You know, they call it a private company, but I mean, it's mostly, you know, he's getting billions of dollars to develop things for NASA. So it's government money. And then the subsidies for Tesla. I mean, people have rightly pointed out that Tesla is largely only exists because of government subsidies. It wouldn't exist otherwise. You know, all this stock, the Tesla stock so high, people made a lot of money. Yeah, due to government subsidies floating the company.
Exactly. You know, without the preferential treatment, that industry doesn't exist. Nobody would be investing in that at all.
Government
preference. He's a politician capitalist, it's what it's called. A politician hyphen capitalist.
Exactly that. And what I'd like to do is just to throw into the mix that we've got other people, you know, these front men who share this common theme that they don't come across as highly intelligent. They come across as midwits. Mark Zuckerberg, for example, Mark Zuckerberg at Facebook. I mean, when he was called before Congress, he just crumbled, didn't he, to testify and justify his actions on Facebook. He was not a compelling speaker. He didn't advocate very well for his position. Likewise, when you look at Bill Gates, you know, the man who so-called created the wonderful empire that is Microsoft, again, when you see him speak, you're kind of dumbfounded to think, is this guy really the head of a multi-trillion dollar organization. And
John, you know, that's really pointing out something good. You're pointing out a really good correlation that needs to be made. So what I just said about being struck this way about Elon Musk, you're right. These other characters and that phrase that you used for them, frontmen, I think that you've really identified something here. And it's almost like there's some force behind the scenes which prefers a particular personality type, which you just said is consistent between all these fellows. They're really brain dead midwits. They don't come across as very intelligent people whatsoever. It seems to be that there's a personality type for the frontmen that they like to put up.
We didn't mention Jack Dorsey again. You know, he's exactly. Coming out and giving the sham excuse that he was manipulated. Well, he probably is manipulated. They're all manipulated. And I think of the Klaus Schwab's World Economic Forum, the idea of the Young Leaders Initiative. These people are very compliant. They're groomed from an early age. They've had 10, 20 years or more being coached on what to say. They don't rock the boat. They're no threat to their bosses. And again, they're just the front, aren't they? They kind of look the part. They look quite charismatic. You know, you could argue that Elon Musk is a certain suave character. You could argue that Jack Dorsey, again, these are reasonably pleasant people to look at. Then, you know, they're not striking in any way, are they? Very mediocre. You know, they're quite bland characters. There's nothing about them that grabs you. As you say, that they come across as you know, uninspiring. And yet, these uninspiring types of people are leading huge corporations. You know, Joe Wilson, what's your thought on this?
I'll just say, sorry, Joe. Yeah, let's go. Sorry, Joe. I'll just quickly put in there and say, John, it's almost like you're identifying that there's a hidden hand behind that all, some other structure that's controlling all these people. Anyway, sorry. Go ahead, Joe.
Yeah, DARPA was created the internet. But they had a problem in the late 90s. There was a scalability issue where you couldn't get more than about 8 or 10 computers online at the same time communicating with each other because the system just couldn't handle it. So there was a company up in Ohio named Leader Technology, led by Michael McKibben, who's a civil engineer. They wrote 750,000 lines of code that solved the scalability problem. They submitted their patent and they were directed to go to James P. Chandler, who was the patent attorney for Hillary Clinton, which you got to wonder what in the world patents did Hillary Clinton ever need to file? Well, it turns out they're all run by Serco, the biggest company you never heard of that runs the U.S. Patent Office and steals every worthwhile patent in the nation. Okay, so Chandler goes, man, this is a great idea, but we don't want you guys to develop it. We wanted to give it to our own little handpicked puppets. So one of the handpicked puppets they went to was through Larry Summers, who had been the U.S. Treasury Department Secretary under Slick Willie and Rep Tillery back between 99 and 2001. He had moved over to Harvard, where he was head of the university. They contacted him and said, you got somebody at your school that you could give this information to? And he goes, oh, yeah, we'll give it to this little clown that came up with a phone book for the people here in his own little dorm. I guarantee you, Zuckerberg never wrote a line of code in his life. And amazingly enough, there was a similar program that was being operated by the U.S. military that the day that Facebook went public, they went completely offline. So they abandoned all of their stuff, but theirs was just a precursor to what the real technology was. And that's the technology that allows Eric Schmidt with Google and YouTube and the Steve Jobs and all of the rest of them to do their networking systems and make everything on the internet work is because they stole the patents. And these are nothing but a bunch of little boy kings that are made out to be these great geniuses when in fact they did next to nothing. Go ahead.
Yeah, Joe, I'll just point out that does actually connect back to, precisely what we're talking about exactly. Because, so that program you're talking about was LifeLock, and it was apparently developed by DARPA. And it was just it was a way that they wanted to get people to just, you know, they want to spy on people, but they couldn't figure out how to get everybody to, or they couldn't figure out how to monitor everybody. So they came up with this idea. Let's just make it cool and make it somewhere where people want to put all their personal information on. It was public. So apparently the day that LifeLog was shut down by DARPA, was the very day that Facebook started. And so, yeah, going to the idea that
correct,
like, just put up correct. His front
name. Thank you. Thank
you. It was just done by Mark Zuckerberg while he was writing or while he was living in his dorm to meet women. But really, it was, you know, this whole other, that's just the story. It was this whole other thing. And yeah, maybe it is. Maybe these people are all just front men. They're bland, not particularly intelligent. They're actually quite dull people if you actually think about them. Mark Zuckerberg, I mean, what I was saying about Musk not ever saying anything intelligent, not very intellectually stimulating. Have you ever heard Mark Zuckerberg ever say anything intellectually stimulating? Maybe it's just because these people are autistic. Maybe they're just autists. You know, an autist could develop, you know, the software. You know, if Elon Musk is autistic, yeah, he's probably, you know, autistically studying, you know, electrical engines maybe and a rocket engine. Stuff maybe gets really into it. Maybe that's the common thread. These people, they're simply autists.
Severe autists. Yeah, good point. Contrast and compare with Steve Jobs over at Apple. Did you find him when he was alive? Did you find him the kind of person who could lead a mega corporation? I mean, I watched him speak a few times. He's like a different caliber of leader altogether, isn't he? Did you find that?
Yeah, why don't we go to William for that? You know, I don't know much about Steve Jobs. What do you think, William?
No, I don't know much about him as a person. I think what we're sort of tapping into is these people have friends in high places, particularly they've got friends in finance, in the banking community, in these big investment funds, BlackRock. I recently put an article out called Rise of the Climate Oligarchs, and I just profiled four of the leading climate oligarchs, but when I was, one of which was, there's hundreds of these people. I mean, there's our billionaires who have invested heavily in the climate industrial complex, and they're actively promoting climate alarmism to defend their investments. There's hundreds of these people. Their ability to mobilize investment money. Like when he went to buy Twitter, even if you are worth $100 billion, it doesn't mean you can snap your fingers and have $44 billion in cash. The only people who have that are the bankers in the major cities. You have to have friends there, and you have to have more than one. Because those guys are great believers in not putting all their eggs in one basket. So you have to have quite a community of friends amongst the high finance community to go out and suddenly buy something for $44 billion. And if you look at the biographies of a lot of the Elon Musks and the Bill Gates and that, boy, they sure had access to financing when they needed it. Because quite often there's up-and-coming companies, and it's fairly obvious that they're onto something that's going to be very lucrative. And people like Bill Gates and Musk, they can step right in, and for some reason they've got this unlimited line of credit, and they can grab what they call them the unicorn. These are new tech businesses that are obviously going to be big hits. And so groups like, you know, the cartel or cliques around groups like Musk and Gates and what have you, they're like hawks, and they're waiting for these, and they've got no shortage of financing problems. They have no shortage of financing. And they can swoop in and grab these little companies. That's what Musk and these guys have been doing. Like, for him to, on a whim, come up with $44 billion in cash, no.
Yeah, ridiculous.
That takes a lot of friends.
Jabe, just before you go any further, I just want to allow listeners to do a bit of research themselves. Don't trust us. Don't take our word for it. There's a very useful website where you can actually go and check yourself. It's www.conservapedia.com. And it has a section on young global leaders. And young global leaders was set up in 1993 by Klaus Schwab. And it's very revealing because the list of names is shocking, really. Gavin Newsom, you've got Ivanka Trump, you've got George P. Bush, you've got Elon Musk, you've got a long list, Nikki Haley, you've got Justin Trudeau. All these names, these are people who went through the World Economic Forum Grooming Academy under Klaus Schwab. I'll go on a bit more, I'll give you a few more on this. Emmanuel Macron, Volodymyr Zelensky, president of Ukraine. It's just unbelievable. I'm scrolling through the list and it's just eye-opening. And I urge listeners, you know, if you're down in New Zealand, Jacinda Ardern, she's on the list. You've got other names. I mean, it's just baffling that these people, Mark Zuckerberg, Bill Gates, Jeff Bezos, Jimmy Wales of Wikipedia, Larry Page, founder of Google, co-founder of Google. It's just phenomenal. And this is what you can fairly describe as a conspiracy. It's a conspiracy. The organizer, Klaus Schwab, has control over these individuals. Anderson Cooper. Anderson Cooper of CNN is there. You know, Leonardo DiCaprio is there. Ashton Kutcher, actor, is there. Charlize Theron, South African actor, there. It just mind-boggling, the list of names scrolling through. Now, you know, is that undue influence? Do you think that's worthy of criticism? Do you think that that's power concentrated in the hands of one organization, even one man, Klaus Schwab, self-confessed globalist? You know, this is something that everybody should be aware of. And this is not conspiracy theory. This is conspiracy fact, isn't it, gentlemen?
I would push back on the notion that Klaus Schwab tells these people what to think. I don't think he has that kind of influence or control over them. The difficulty with that analysis is that it's too much focused on the WEF and Charles Schwab, or Klaus Schwab.
Yeah.
I can remember the day when it was all about the Bilderberg Summit, and people had convinced themselves that this cabal was swinging the world around by the tail. Before that, it was the Council on Foreign Relations, and it was the CIA. The reality is there are dozens of organizations like the WEF. What they are forums. They are conventions. Mm. They are opportunities for elite business leaders, elite government ministers, to sit around and have frank, informal discussions and try to get their act together. But looking at the list, you see, okay, there's also a bunch of rivalry in there. It isn't as they go away from these conventions like Manchurian candidates with all this programmed information that they're going to robotically recite. No, they try to get their act together. Schwab is trying to get these people to cooperate. He's not always succeeding. And that's not the only organization that's doing it. The Bilderberg Summit is still doing it. I focus more on groups like the International Energy Agency, you know, the UNFCCC, NATO, and some of the other major UN organizations, the UNEP, the United Nations Environment Program. These are also nubs. Like the UNEP requires that every country that's a member, and it's all the industrial side, is send their environment ministers every 2 years to a convention of their choosing. And I've seen photographs of some of these rooms, like 2,000 people in the room. Every one of them is an employee of a national environment ministry. The UNEP does that every 2 years. The IEA does that every 2 years with the national energy ministers of all the industrial countries. So there's a lot of organizations that are acting upon our governments and our business elites in an effort to corral them and to control them. But it's a pretty crowded room. And the mistake is to fixate on any particular one of those organizations and to lose the fact that there's actually a forest of these organizations, and there's a lot of rivalry amongst and within them.
Good point, William Kay. We're going to cut back to another news break. This is TNT Radio.
Give me a minute with TNT Radio's Steve Malzberg.
We've all heard the cute agenda-driven questions by now, designed to tear down more and more of our societal norms and throw our world into a chaotic mess. What's the definition of a man? What's the definition of a woman? Those are two of the most popular. Well, the Cambridge Dictionary now has capitulated by changing the definition of both. Man is now an adult who lives and identifies as a male, though they may have been said to have a different sex at birth. Same new definition for a woman. The New York Post documents social media reaction to the sick changes. Conservative talk show host Steven Crowder tweeted, "Remember, if you can control the language, you can control the population." I happen to like the Daily Caller writer Mary Rook, who called the dictionary writers effing traitors to the truth. Folks, we are losing our world to the nut jobs on the radical left who have infiltrated just about everything and everywhere. Thanks for giving me a minute. I'm Steve Malzberg for TNT Radio.
Challenging the consensus and debunking the narrative. This is Viewpoint.
The Caesar Rodney Election Research Institute, CREI's, investigation of the US 2020 election found that Facebook founder Mark Zuckerberg's spending increased Biden's vote by a total of about 200,000 votes in Texas alone. Though the difference wasn't enough to flip the state blue last year, grant money from the Center for Technology and Civic Life, CTCL, and the Center for Election Innovation and Research, CEIR, CTL, and CEIR may have pushed Biden over the top in other swing states. The preliminary results in Georgia and Wisconsin suggested a similar impact on Biden's vote margin from CTCL spending, and spending in those states was likely large enough and targeted enough to have shifted them into Biden's column. Joe Biden was certified the winner of the Georgia presidential election by just 11,000 votes, and of Wisconsin's election by around 20,000 votes.
Our next steps to space.
This time we go back to the moon to learn to live, to work, to invent, to create.
Today's News Talk Radio, TNT.
William Kay, you wrote the book, The Green Swastika, Environmentalism in the Third Reich. We haven't touched on that yet. Your book is on Amazon. It's very well rated. You've got 4.5 stars. And what I like about that is you've done a bit of a deep dive into Nazi Germany and how it is actually focused on environmentalism. Give us a little summary of what you found out in your book.
Well, every leading Nazi figure, Goring, Hitler, Himmler, Dar, who has now been erased from history, they were all raving environmentalists. They were raving ecologists. Ecology itself is a pseudoscience which emerged in Germany in the 1860s. It emerged as a result of a competition over land use between a rising sort of capitalist farmer crowd and the old guard aristocratic crowd who wanted to keep the medieval forms of agriculture. And part of the fight back was a cultural campaign to convince people that, you know, eliminating all the hedgerows and regulating the rivers was going to cause an ecological catastrophe. That's in the 1860s. When people talk, you know, say, well, wasn't environmentalism a 60s thing? I say, yeah, it was a 60s thing. It was an 1860s thing. But it had been a powerful movement. Germany had a huge environmental movement at the turn of the century. You know, there were hundreds of thousands of people who belonged to various tree-hugging groups. They'd already had an acid rain scare in the 19th century. And they fought against hydroelectric damming. They fought against industrialization. And after the fall of the Kaiser, when the fascist movement started mobilizing, that was one constituency in which they mobilized. And in fact, it gets to a point where you could say that almost every member of a conservationist or land preservationist group in Germany prior to 1933 was also a member of a fascist organization, if not the Nazi Party itself. And they merge even closer after the Nazis take power. All the leading, you know, bird protection societies and park preservationists had swastikas on their newsletters. They were openly promoting Nazism throughout the entire Third Reich. So the concept organic foods was invented by the Third Reich Agricultural Ministry. It was basically an effort, once again, to romanticize and glorify medieval pre-industrial agriculture. There was a cabinet meeting of top Nazi ministers about whether or not to impose organic foods onto the entire population. And but for Goring and Bormann, they would have done it. But Goring and Bormann managed to convince them that if we go totally organic while we're about to start a war with the Soviet Union, we are going to starve to death. So they fought that off. But it was a close battle, and almost every leading Nazi figure ate nothing but organic foods. I mean, a lot of the characteristics that we attribute to the environmental movement existed in spades amongst the leading Nazis. Ultimately, it has its roots in the aristocracy's hostility to industrialization, the aristocracy's fear that they were going to lose control of the state to the business class, the aristocracy's dread that someday land itself would be treated like any other commodity and thrown on the market like any other commodity. That was the ultimate dread of the aristocracy. It was a fundamentally anti-capitalist, but it was definitely not a socialist movement. And that's what a lot of people fundamentally don't understand about environmentalism today or the climate campaign. This is not a movement of the radical left. The radical left barely exists anymore in the English-speaking world. The movement that we're seeing right now, this is a movement that definitely has its roots in the European fascist movement. That is incontrovertible.
Yes, good point. Your knowledge of history is very robust. I read the first three chapters. I've not read your whole book. I admit that I've not read your whole book, but it's well worth reading the first chapter, and because it's free for anybody to read. And you know, the green swastika, it's an interesting read, and I like the fact that you have done something we've been doing at Principia Scientific, which is calling out green fascism, and every which way you look, it's about shutting down dissent, isn't it? There's no debate. It's a one-party state, one-party system, you just toe the line. Holistic science, and
like I say, in Canada, we have a choice of green parties. We have three or four parties. They're all green, you know, and that's what we call democracy. But they're all ramming through a very green, very pro-climate agenda that is so obviously contrary to the interests of most Canadians. But we it's a one-party state. We in Canada right now.
Yeah, I speak as a school teacher of 20 years before I got into writing and Principia Scientific International. I did about 20 years as a school teacher in England and Wales, and I can tell you that the first paragraph of your book, where you outline these areas of so-called I call them virtue signaling. You've got species preservation, you've got species reintroduction, invasive species eradication, blah, 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 naturalism, neo-paganism, pantheism, sun worship, religion of nature, holistic science and medicine, herbalism, animal rights, etc., biofields. This is something I was teaching 15, 20 years ago. So this has gone through generations, hasn't it? The young today, correct me if I'm wrong, we're all of an older generation here. I remember growing up in the 60s and 70s, and the youth of that era were meant to be anti-establishment. And yet, conversely, now the youth are pro-establishment. So indoctrination does seem to be working through the education system. Would you agree with that?
Yes, there was also a lot of sort of pseudo-radicalism in the 60s and 70s, too. I tend to view the hippie movement as sort of a fake movement, an astroturf movement, and it harbored a lot of the sort of green swastika features in that. And when you mentioned all those things like paganism, these were prominent features across the entire European fascist movement. You know, they wanted to revitalize pagan religions and things like that. The revitalization of witchcraft and occultism, these were things that they also promoted. And it was all tied up into the whole nature God. There's a two-volume encyclopedia called The Encyclopedia of Religion and Nature. And it came together by accident. One guy was actually studying the neo-Nazi movements in the United States. And he was astonished by how often they used the phrase Mother Nature or the nature God, etc. And he went to a conference on religion, and he came across another guy who was studying the history of the religion of nature, like the history of the fanatical tree hugger type personality. Yeah. And he was writing a history of that. And he came to a realization that once you get into the 1920s and 30s, everybody who's advocating this sort of nature religion has got a swastika on their arm. Yeah. And the one guy noticed that there was a continuity there. And it has its roots in a hostility to industrialization, a hostility to unregulated industrialization. It has its roots in that sort of mentality there. But the encyclopedia itself, I read both volumes. I harvested 400 pieces of evidence connecting the European fascist movement to the modern environmental movement. I mean, it is incontrovertible. I initially wanted to do a sequel to the Green Swastika, to do biographies of the 40 or 50 leading environmentalists who, prior to 1945, where we're raving fascists. I'll give you one example. Jorian Jenks was the agriculture critic for the British Union of Fascists. Winston Churchill locked him up in jail for World War II. He was an outspoken supporter of Luftwaffe bombing of London. After World War II, he sets up an organization called the Soil Association. They have a newsletter called Mother Earth, and he goes on to become the leading promoter of organic foods in the UK until he dies. And that is one example out of, you know, 101 I could recite off the top of my head of people who, before 1945, were very active in the European fascist movement, and who, after 1945, become leaders of the Green Movement, the conservationist movement. There is unmistakable continuity.
Yeah,
and the founder.
Jake. Just to round off the fact that I've read the first chapter, and one of the things I loved in your first chapter of your book is that you identified the Nazi intellectual vanguard were pushing the trope of nature's precarious balance. And that's something I hadn't picked up on before, that something that you've identified is specific to Nazi Germany, that nature has a precarious balance. And it's entirely what we've been told today, isn't it? That nature is very finely balanced and we are in danger of ruining it. And I love the way you nailed that. Sorry, Joel, carry on.
That is the core trope of ecology. The core trope of ecology is that any human interference on nature will be avenged by nature. And that we're starting with this pristine thing that it's in delicate balance, and these evil humans keep sort of messing with it and monkeying around with it. That is the premise of ecology, that we're beginning with an Eden. The fact is there's no balance to nature. It's one damn thing after another. It's an ice age followed by massive volcanoes, followed by meteorites, species wiping out other species. There's no direction to nature. There's a direction to human history. There's a direction to human technological development. But nature is not something to be preserved or emulated, and there certainly isn't any balance to it. Sooner or later, there's going to be another ice age that's going to go all the way to the equators, just like the Huronian ice age, and we're going to spend 100 million years as a snowball. And if we don't have the technological ability to survive that, we're going to perish.
Joe Olson?
Yes, amazingly enough, the founder of the greenhouse gas theory was Svante Arrhenius, who was the founder of the Swedish Institute for Racial Biology and was honored by the Nazis. So if you want to virtue signal something, why aren't you virtue signaling this SJW violator of the first degree? Raging eugenicist that was only one race should exist on the planet and we should exterminate all the rest of them. The guy was absolutely insane. But there you go. You got a green environmental movement that manages to attack everybody else but their own founders and their own ridiculous tropes that they launch for their saving the planet. It's just insane the way these people can wrap themselves around this ridiculous set of parameters and then claim that they're virtuous and nobody else on the planet is. It's really absurd, but maybe we're reaching the end of that paradigm.
Yeah, just chuck into that mix that Svante Arrhenius' granddaughter is none other than the wonderful Greta Thunberg. Greta. You know, this is just astonishing, isn't it? It's a very small club, isn't it? A very small club, and it's just eye-opening, really, when you realise these people have such sway over the intelligentsia. You know, the powers that be. William, we've got another couple of minutes before the end of the show. I mean, anything we've not yet covered you want to throw into the mix?
Well, hopefully people get a chance to read that Aussies Go 100% Coal. I'm increasingly becoming a real coal booster. There was briefly a website which I contributed to called Burn More Coal, but it's kind of dormant now. But I am hopeful. There is a fight back starting. Good news story to follow is that Vanguard one, that Vanguard investment company, decided they were not going to cooperate anymore with promoting this climate crap on the companies that they invest in. That is big. And there's some of the stuff that's being promoted in the Republican Congress right now that are resisting climate is big. That's what we got to hope for. And dreary as it is, that's the hope. But it's polarizing and it's coming to a head. So it's an important topic to be knowledgeable about.
Yeah, I share your optimism, William, and I think a lot of us do see there is possibilities of a breakthrough. They talk about the Great Awakening. People like our good selves, we try and share information. We don't pretend we have all the answers, but we do encourage people to do their own self-directed learning. It's a concept that needs to be mentioned a bit more often. Self-directed learning, you just start from your home base, don't you? You start from your core beliefs and you work from that. You don't abandon everything and just allow authority to tell you what to do. And I really welcome you writing more for us. We've published quite a few of your articles at Principia Scientific. You appear quite regularly on TNT Radio. You've done a lot of research, and there are a lot of people out there worth listening to, and you're one of them. Have you got any plans to do any more writing? Because this article on the coal thing is wonderful for Australian listeners.
I want to do one for each one of the USA and the UK, like each one of those countries. If they just dropped all the renewable energy BS and just went back to coal-fired power, it would be such a blessing for them. It would be cheap electricity. Yeah. The money would stay in the country. It is just an outrage that we are being imposed upon to drop what is our key asset here, the coal fields. Not so much Canada, but we're losing our access to our petroleum fields, which is going to be just as devastating. But it is clear that there are energy policies are being forced upon the English-speaking world that are not in the best interest of the citizens who live there. There is a colonial imperial relationship whereby the Europeans are imposing an energy policy onto us that benefits them and not us.
William Kay, thank you very much for appearing on Sky Dragon Slaying. Hopefully we'll have you again soon. Thank you very much.